Maryland lost 60% of its honeybee colonies last year, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That puts the state in the top five for honeybee deaths in the country. Population losses at this rate could be disastrous for both the pollinators and the U.S. economy. The honeybee plays an integral role in agriculture, accounting for an estimated $15 billion in value to crops annually. Maryland beekeepers and scientists join us in this hour of midday to talk about the controversial factors contributing to the deaths of honeybees. And we'll hear from a state legislator who wants to target pesticides in the effort to stop the colony's collapse. The plight of the honeybee on midday after the news from NPR. In the United States, bees are in trouble, honeybees. For many of us, that in itself is not news. You've heard this before. For close to a decade, beekeepers and scientists have been studying the causes of what's called colony collapse disorder, CCD, or a dead honeybee colony without any adult bees. The honeybee population nationally decreased some 40% in 2014. And in Maryland, that number was disturbingly worse. A survey issued by the U.S. Department of Agriculture just last month showed that Maryland saw the death of some 61% of its honeybee colonies. Only four states saw higher percentages in losses. Late last month, the Obama administration announced new steps to promote pollinator health. The Pollinator Health Task Force is an interagency initiative created by the Obama administration, and the plans released last month include three goals. They're to reduce honeybee colony losses to economically sustainable levels, increase monarch butterfly numbers to protect the annual migration of the monarchs, and restore or enhance millions of acres of land for pollinators through combined public and private action. We'll talk about that in this hour of the show as we explore the reason for the decline in honeybees and what can be done to bring them back. Earlier this year, Maryland legislature saw a pollinator health legislation or bill, the Pollinator Protection Act, a bill that was designed to halt the sale of certain pesticides at the consumer level. And environmentalists lobbied, albeit unsuccessfully, for its passage. For many in the beekeeping community, these pesticides are the number one threat to contributing to the death of so many bees. Still, others say there is not sufficient evidence to suggest that proper use of these particular pesticides would kill bees on a scale this large. We'll explore that in this hour of the show. Maryland State Delegate Ann Healy will be joining us. She was the sponsor of that bill. Also, we'll be hearing from Bonnie Raindrop, the legislative chair of the Central Maryland Beekeepers Association. She'll be with us today, as well as Sam Droege, biologist, veteran Maryland beekeeper, a photographer, and co-author of a new book that will change the way you think of bees forever. That's a new book that we'll be telling you about in this hour of the show. First off, I want to welcome Dennis Van Engelsdorp to the show, an entomologist from the University of Maryland, project director of the Bee-Informed Partnership, the BIP, the Bee-Informed Partnership. That group, along with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, put out that survey I mentioned earlier. So, Dennis, I want to thank you and welcome you to the Midday Show, Dennis Van Engelsdorp.
Thank you, and thanks for your interest.
Dennis, let's go over the main factors that lead to this, well, we'll call it colony collapse, just to review some of what we know so far about this.
Well, I think it's important to note that colony collapse disorder, in our original sense of the word, was to describe a symptom of how colonies died that was unique. It turns out that we've seen this several times over the last 200 years, very isolated episodes of it, where you saw the rapid loss of a colony. So a colony had 40,000 members, you'd see all those bees disappear within 2 weeks. Since then, colony collapse disorder has meant a broader thing, like any dead colony. And certainly that's of concern because we've seen very high rates of winter loss for the last 10 years, about 30%. And now that's hard for beekeepers. I think it's really important, though, to point out that a 30% winter loss doesn't mean we have 30% fewer colonies in the country. Because beekeepers are very unique in the sense that if they have a living colony and a dead colony, they can split their living colony in half, buy a queen, and have two colonies. And so they can replace their losses really quickly. And that's why, in fact, over the last 10 years, the number of colonies, as we count them in the summer, has increased, not gone down. But it's very hard for these beekeepers to keep replacing those losses. So we're not worried necessarily that bees are going to go extinct, honeybees are going to extinct. We're worried that the large commercial beekeepers are going to go extinct because they can't afford to keep replacing those losses.
Hmm. Dennis, use of that term colony collapse disorder, I've heard it more and more, and it sounds so ominous. Do you think it's been used too much or it's a misnomer?
Well, I think that our original intent was to describe a very specific symptom of colonies dying that we didn't understand. I think, though, it's caught the public's imagination, and everything now is being called colony collapse disorder. I'm not sure whether we, you know, a dead colony is a dead colony, and at the end of the day, we have to figure out what's driving these high levels of dead colonies. And so I think it's something that resonates with people, and so that might be a good thing. I think it does cloud the issue a little. So I think it has both positive and negative. I think the important message, though, is colonies are dying at unsustainable rates, and this we need to address this if we want to continue to produce fruits and vegetables in this country.
Would you do me a favor and just take a minute here and explain to people, pardon if this sounds like a sophomore question, but it's a basic thing we should go over, why this is so important. In the outset of the show, I mentioned a $15 billion value on crops in the United States that honeybees bring to those crops. And I don't think we should just skip over this. The reason we're talking about honeybees, this doesn't have to do with honey alone. This is a serious issue.
You're absolutely right. About one in every three bites of food we eat are pollinated directly or indirectly by honeybees. And in order to produce fruits and nuts in this country, we need to have a movable pollination force. And so that means there are about 2,000 beekeepers in this country who have trucks, and they truck their colonies around the country to pollinate different crops. So right now, a lot of colonies are leaving Maine, where they've just pollinated blueberries. Some are going to Massachusetts to pollinate cranberries. They'll then go down to on the eastern shore there to do maybe cucumbers or some other pumpkins, then go down to Florida. And then the big event is in California in February, where over half the colonies in the country, so over half of the 3.5 million colonies in the country, go to California to pollinate almonds. And that's a huge event. And then they disperse again to sort of go up the East Coast or West Coast to pollinate apples and different fruit crops. So without honeybees, we wouldn't be able to produce those fruits and nuts like we do today. And it's important that they're movable, one, because a lot of these areas, there's nothing there except for that crop. And so when that crop's in bloom, it's great for the bees. But after it's in bloom, there's not much left food for them. So it couldn't support that number of colonies.
Okay. Thank you very much for doing that, Dennis. I want to, before I move on to Delegate Ann Healy, who's going to join our conversation in a moment, I want to go over with you the contribution to collapse of honeybees made by the mite that we heard so much about in the last few years. I think it's the Varroa mite. Is that right?
That's right. So we really do believe that the Varroa mite is a major driver of a lot of these losses. These are large parasitic mites. They're like little vampires, and so they're sucking on these bees, taking their food from the adult bees and the young bees. But importantly, they're also spitting in viruses to the bees. And so because of this, we think the viruses that have had a long association with honeybees have mutated and become much more virulent. And so we think that the Varroa mite is killing bees because of these changed virus families that have now associated with the Varroa mite. And so that's made it much more difficult to keep colonies alive at low, because you need to keep your mite levels so much lower than you did, say, 30 years ago when mites first came into the country.
And the other thing I wanted to cover with you before we go to Delegate Healy is habitat loss. I felt pretty good this spring seeing a fair number of honeybees in my backyard because I don't put anything on my backyard. I don't use pesticides. I don't use herbicides. I don't use anything. And I've got plenty of clover there. The rabbits love it, and the honeybees love it. But one of the factors here is habitat loss.
You're absolutely right. And that's really changed. If we look at sort of where most of the colonies in this country go over the summer, it's in North Dakota and South Dakota. And if we look at what's happened to land there because of the price of corn and soybean, thousands, hundreds of thousands of acres that used to be meadows are now being plowed under with corn and soybean, which isn't good food habitat. And this is where I think we need to take really big action, because if we can provide good food for bees, and not just honeybees, but also the thousands of species of native bees that we have in this country, I think that's a great thing. So exactly what you said, I think, is really exciting. We need to move away from this idea that the perfectly green, flat lawn is a beautiful thing. It's not. It's an ecological desert. And we need to encourage flowering plants in our lawns. Some people call those weeds, but it's bee food. And I think that we need to change our mindset. And in so doing, we provide a lot more habitat and food for honeybees and native bees.
Dennis Van Engelsdorp is an entomologist at the University of Maryland and the project director of the Bee Informed Partnership, the BIP, that we haven't really talked about, but I'll take a minute there and ask you about that before we take our break, Dennis. Let me go to Ann Healy first. Ann Healy is a delegate from Prince George's County. I mentioned her earlier. She's the sponsor of the Pollinator Protection Act, and this bill failed to pass in the legislature this year, but is important as to what it had to say or what it tried to do, what Ann Healy and her co-sponsors tried to achieve with this. So, Delegate Healy, thank you for being with us on the Midday Show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Let's speak specifically about the Pollinator Protection Act, what it would have done had it passed, and I assume you're not finished with this, so we may be hearing about it again in the next session. But anyway, what was the idea here?
Well, the idea really was what you talked about earlier about the education of the public and the proper use of pesticides, particularly these neonicotinoids. They're called neonics. They're kind of a derivative from nicotine, and they're a very serious pesticide that's used throughout the country in agriculture. What my bill did was it would say that if you wanted to use these as a homeowner, you would have to go to not your ordinary retailer, but to a place where that's what they sell to the professionals. And also at the plant stores and the Home Depots and places like that, they would label what has been treated with these pesticides for consumer use. We were very careful not to touch what was going on in agriculture, but really just to help encourage people to do what you've done and kind of let their backyards be natural.
Mm-hmm. The neonics, neonics, N-E-O-N-I-C-S for short there. What's so special about these pesticides? Why do they pose such a threat to honeybees?
Well, one reason is they actually get into the plant, and so it's not like something that's sprayed. It's like it becomes part of the plant. When the pollinator pollinates it, they can be affected by it. And we had testimony in the committee that one of the things that happens is that the pollinators, the bees, get disoriented, can't find their way back to the hive, they can get sick, they can carry the disease, not the disease, but the poison, the toxicity that is supposed to take care of pests, mm-hmm. but also affects other insects. And they can take that back to their hive, and that can cause problems in the hive. We've had cases where, you know, the anecdotal stories of people who are having a garden party and they overdo it with pesticides. It's really an education for the homeowners to avoid using these things, because pollinators are really important to the food supply, really and truly.
I mean, your bill sounds like it's one of those bills with lots of common sense and logic to it. So what happened in the legislature? What was the resistance?
Well, in my opinion, the big guns, the manufacturers of these pesticides, really went all out. They hired lobbyists. They lobbied not only the committee, but also the administration. And it was the administration I have been working with and talked to, and I wasn't sure where they were going to end up on it. At the very end, they decided to oppose the bill. But we had a very good hearing, and even though the opposition brought in their own scientists and there was a lot of debate, our committee decided to take another look at it over the interim, and we're going to have really study the scientific literature on this, because these neonics have been banned in Europe, and there's a professor in England who studied more than 1,000 studies about the effects of these and recommended that they be banned in Europe, and the European countries have banned it. So we're going to continue to look at it. I'm not asking for a ban. I want to be very clear about that. I think that I'm really talking about something much smaller step in that direction. And just because I think people should really be informed about what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for joining us today. And good luck with that. We'll check back with you maybe next year on that.
Okay, very
yep.
good.
Delegate Ann Healy of Prince George's County, member of the Maryland House of Delegates. And before I let our guest Dennis Van Engelsdorp go here and we take our first break, that's very interesting. It's a learning process for me a little bit on neonics, learning more here as I go. But there must be, are there other chemical threats to honeybees? Are there that mite we talked about earlier, the varroa mite, for instance? Is there a pesticide used just for the mite? Are fungicides used? Anything like that? Do those also pose threats to honeybees?
Well, that's a really good question. So we think that there are three major drivers of colony loss. One is varroa mite, and I think that can't be overstated, as we've talked about. One is certainly poor nutrition because of habitat loss and that there's just not good forage out there in many parts of the country anymore. And the third is pesticides. And those pesticides include the pesticides that beekeepers use to control mites. And it's a lot like chemotherapy. You don't do chemotherapy because it's good for you. It's just better than the alternative. And so we need to explore, and I think there are new products out there that are less toxic to bees and cause less harm to them. But at the end of the day, we're still trying to kill a bug, which is a mite, on a bee, which is another bug. So it's a tricky balancing act. But I think there are some new tools out there that beekeepers can use. But certainly, I think that we need to look at the data and follow the data when it comes to pesticides. And we certainly see a lot of different products, on average, three different products in a sample from a colony in the pollen. So we're finding lots of different products. And certainly, we are concerned about things like fungicides, which are traditionally thought of as very safe for bees. But it turns out they may have sublethal effects. So having this fungicide there predisposes bees to getting other diseases. I do want to say one thing, if I can, and that is we're talking about honeybees, and honeybees are social organisms. So there's a big argument that we shouldn't look at a bee as a living thing, but the whole colony. It's this superorganism. And this superorganism, it turns out, when we do the check its DNA, we find that it doesn't have all the same genes to detoxify or fight infection that fruit flies do. And that's because there's a level of immunity given by being part of this big collective. So you can kill 30% of the colony's workforce, and that colony survive. And so they're very, very resilient to pesticide poisoning. However, these native bees that I think Sam is going to talk about aren't nearly as resilient. And so I think our concerns about pesticides are probably even more concern for these native bees. And so I think that's an important part of the equation.
And Dennis, quickly, what is the Bee Informed Partnership actually?
So the Bee Informed Partnership is a collaboration between a whole bunch of universities and beekeepers, where what we're trying to do is do a broad scale monitoring of bee health across the country and also identify practices that help beekeepers keep their colonies alive. And so we try to communicate beekeepers' practices that help keep their colonies alive. So, for instance, varroa mite control, we consistently see that 60% of small-scale beekeepers aren't treating for varroa, and they need to, and those beekeepers consistently lose a lot more colonies than those who do treat.
Dennis, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, very informative. Dennis Van Engelsdorp, who's an entomologist at the University of Maryland and project director of that program he was just describing, the Bee Informed Partnership. This is Midday. We're going to take a break here and talk some more about the honeybees when we get back. You're welcome to ask questions of our guests, Bonnie Raindrop of the Central Maryland Beekeepers Association, and the Sam that Dennis just mentioned is Sam Droege, wildlife biologist, who's out with a new book about bees. 410-662-8780. If you have comments or questions during this hour, you can also send us a question by email, midday at wypr.org. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here now with Bonnie Raindrop, who's a Maryland beekeeper.
Yes.
And serves as legislative chair of the Central Maryland Beekeepers Association, which means you spend time in Annapolis, I guess this past year, working with Ann Healy in particular on the Pollinator Protection Act.
Yes, I did. We were part of a larger coalition called the Smart on Pesticides Coalition that worked to support that legislation. And that actually was comprised of over 60 different public health, environmental health, beekeeper organizations. It was a very broad cross-section of people that were concerned and wanted to see this legislation pass.
I have some more questions about that during the hour for you, Bonnie. So thanks for being here today. And I also want to welcome back to our studio wildlife biologist Sam Droege from the Patuxent Wildlife Research Center. Sam has been on our show before to talk about what's going on with honeybees in the world. And I was glad to see that Sam now is out with a book. He's a co-author with Lawrence Packer of Bees, An Up-Close Look at Pollinators Around the World, published by Vanguard. It's nice to have you back on the show, Sam. Nice to see you.
Thanks, Dan.
And congratulations on the book. Also, we came across Flickr. No, not Flickr.
Yeah.
What is it? Is it
you
Flickr?
Mean where the pictures are?
The photographs of the honeybees that are astounding photographs.
Honeybees and all kinds of bees.
Yeah. I put a link to it on my Facebook page this morning so others can check that out. So anyways,
all public domain.
Sam, nice to have you back with us. We were talking about decline in honeybees last time you were on the show. What do you make of this survey? Those numbers I gave early in the hour here, kind of disturbing or not?
It is. And I think Bonnie can speak to it more in terms of what the impacts are locally, but it's not the kind of business you want to get into right now because it's so difficult to maintain the kind of colonies and the numbers and the kind of impacts from introduced diseases and other factors that are moving in right now, plus the habitat loss factors, to add up to something that makes it difficult to really run a business.
What do you think is the biggest factor of those three that we went over with Dennis? The mite, the neonics, habitat loss?
I'm going to say if it's for the native species of bees, again, a very different group, nothing we manage per se, that is all about habitat loss. And I'm going to let Bonnie talk about what the issues are for honeybees. I mean, I have my opinions, but I'm not the expert on honeybees that she is.
Go ahead, Bonnie, then. Let's talk about that, because I think it's important. And for people listening who are thinking, you know, what can I do to contribute to this in some way, to, you know, contribute toward a protection of the honeybees, I think it's good to talk about habitat.
It is. I mean, the habitat that exists in our backyards and along our roadsides and in places that we wouldn't ordinarily think about is critically important for honeybees and all pollinators. So we really want people to think twice, three times, four times before they reach for that bottle of chemical that looks so appealing, you know, to, you know, control some pest and not spray and look at what the non-toxic alternatives are. In fact, the coalition put together a list of the common needs for pesticides, and we came up with 146 less toxic products that people can use instead.
To achieve the same result?
Exactly, yeah.
Someone listening to you right now might have said, okay, I like to have a nice green lawn with all grass and nothing in it. I don't like weeds, and I'll just plant a whole bunch of flowers. Well, wouldn't that offset what I'm doing with my lawn?
Well, if you plant flowers that are not already contaminated with neonics, that would be fine. You know, and that's part of the problem that we discovered last year. Friends of the Earth did a study across the country, and 50% of the, quote, bee-friendly plants that people like me and you were going to the garden store to plant for the bees were actually already contaminated. And so a lot of those were contaminated at strengths that would just kill the bee outright. So we feel like that's a real important consumer right-to-know issue. If we're going to be buying things that are contaminated, we want it to be labeled. And that's one of the things that the legislation was trying to do.
The legislation addressed neonics, which is a shortened version of the long
neonicotinoids. Term. Neonicotinoids.
Say it again, Sam.
Neonicotinoids.
Thank you very much, Sam. Again, you agree with Dennis on his assessment of that in terms of it being a factor toward colony loss?
I'm going to leave that up to Dennis for the details, but what it's doing is it's making plants toxic for long periods of time, and those toxins can bleed out into the system, and it's very variable as to when the bloom time is, how it's applied. Is it a soil-based thing, and that that stays in the soil a long period of time? Most other kinds of pesticides, you apply them, and in a few days, they're gone. Here we have the troubling issue that these will last for quite a long period of time.
And show up in the pollen.
They show up in the pollen and the nectar, if it's there. And the plant essentially is poisonous, which is great if you're a nurseryman. So that's why we have these problems that Bonnie mentioned, which is that for a nursery person who wants good-looking plants to sell, he just makes everything poisonous, or she. And I'm simplifying here a lot, but it happens easily because they're not expensive, and it's a deliverable that they can apply. But now we see the downstream is that we're introducing toxic plants which can kill the insects that we like, in addition to the insects that we perhaps don't want to have around at the same time.
A question from one of our listeners in Anne Arundel County in Pasadena. It's Brian. Welcome to Midday. Brian, go right ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is a great show. My question involves the neonicotinoid systemic pesticides that are in the plant but not on it. Now, my question is, when we make the plant itself poisonous to predators, one has to wonder what it's doing to us when we eat those plants, and you're not able to wash those pesticides off from the skin or by peeling it. And so it's had such a great effect on the bees. I wonder what it affects on us. And there's also just one thing. If you go on Netflix, there's a lot of great documentaries that document how neonicotinoid systemic pesticides are really affecting the bee population. So thank you very much for taking my call.
Thank you, Brian, for the question. We'll go to Sam and Bonnie on this, and I'm learning something here today, too. So I'm anyway, this is kind of troubling to think about poisonous plants.
Yeah. So an analog is, in the 60s, we were using a lot of DDT, which also was very toxic and had the great property of that it lasted a long time. It was easy to spray. It built up in the environment and also loaded into animals. That's why we lost ospreys and peregrine falcons regionally. The interesting thing about neonics is that they are also long-lived in soils and other kinds of places. But when the scientists do the kinds of studies where they look at the impacts of that class of chemicals on vertebrates, so there'd be mice and other kinds of things, mm-hmm. they're not seeing these same kind of long-term toxic effects. It isn't the case that we should be dismissive of what the possible causes might be downstream from to us. You know, we are applying a novel chemical. But at this point, the notion is that they are relatively safe to the applicator, which is important, and to the people who are eating the vegetables. How true that is, you know, what are we missing? They've been pretty well studied, so it does look relatively clean for us and for our vertebrate animal friends.
Bonnie?
Well, you know, it's interesting because that is the message that's been promoted. And in fact, when we sat in the hearings down in Annapolis, there were some physicians who testified about this. And they said that research is showing that that neonics are harmful for the developing nervous system and can lead to brain damage in children. So there are some indicators that they were warning the legislative committee about, that this may not be as safe as we thought it was. And the other thing that scientists and the watermen were testifying about was that neonics are toxic to molting blue crabs. So here's something that people really weren't thinking about either, that there's a downstream effect in what it's doing to our fisheries. A lot of the smaller critters that our crabs and fish feed on are being wiped out by neonics, and it's going to have an effect on our crab population as well.
So Fish and Wildlife Service, a pretty conservative organization, has banned neonics on wildlife refuges, and largely it's not because of their impacts on bees, although that was a contributing factor, but it was the water quality issues. So in certain kinds of applications, the neonics can move through the soil and into the streams, and they are doing to the streamside insects, which are the base of food for all the fish and subsequent things. And blue crabs are just an example of another invertebrate that's impacted by these kinds of things as it moves through and down the stream. So these are the kinds of things where better regulations and the kind of applications that we do, we can't be so free with them.
Bonnie, neonics have been around for a long time?
I think they've probably been around a dozen, 15 years.
Oh, that's
like
that's
that.
Not a long time. So
right.
This is something new we have to learn more about. Now, I want to ask you about another chemical, the use of chemicals to fight off the mite that kills bees, the varroa mite. And I heard Dennis Van Engelsdorp say that not all beekeepers in Maryland are using these. And I couldn't tell. I'm not sure whether that's a bad thing or a good thing in his mind. What do you say about it?
Well, I think that beekeepers would prefer it if they didn't have to use chemicals in their hives. You know, we recognize that it's an artificial substance. We don't know exactly what it's doing to the bees. And yet we're in really the horns of a dilemma where the varroa mites are actually, again, there's a synergistic effect of things. The exposure to neonics is proving to make varroa mites more dangerous and more potent. So as Dennis talked about, the viruses that these varroa mites are transmitting into the bees are mutating and they're becoming more deadly. So it's something that beekeepers generally are studying. And if you're a beekeeper these days, you're going to meetings every month. You're listening to scientific researchers come into the clubs and present their research. And we're always looking for better ways to do things. And beekeepers are typically always trying something new, sharing information. So I think there's a real trend happening with, you know, trying to do things better and staying abreast of the research.
Let's take another call. It's Bonnie Raindrop from the Central Maryland Beekeepers Association. Again, wildlife biologist Sam Droege with us now. I can say co-author of Bees, An Up-Close Look at Pollinators Around the World, a new book from Vanguard, his publisher. Gregory in Baltimore will take your call next. Go right ahead, please.
Hi, thank you. I appreciate that. I have always been fascinated by bees, and I think it'd be fantastic to have a hive, a box, in my backyard. I don't know if Baltimore, I live right on the border of Baltimore City. I don't know if that's something I'm allowed to do, but I know there are new hives out there. There are new boxes that are coming out that make it a lot easier to collect honey. And I would love to get into that. I understand that is a positive thing to get more beekeepers. And do I have to be concerned about my neighbors and the chemicals that they have in their lawn, or, you know, is this a possibility that I could actually be a beekeeper?
Go ahead, Bonnie.
Well, you had a lot of great things to say there, and it's exciting when, you know, we get turned on to bees and want to be part of that. I can tell you that it's a lot harder than it used to be, and it can be a very frustrating and expensive experience. One of the things about that new innovation that really swept across the internet with pictures where you would just, you know, turn on a nozzle and you would be able to get honey out of the hive. It looked so great and it makes it look so easy. And in fact, it really isn't easy. But there are new people coming to beekeeping every year. We see this out at the Oregon Nature Center.
In Oregon Ridge.
Oregon Ridge, runs a course every early spring that teaches people how to become beekeepers. And we have a wonderful program that gives people the chance to practice before they get a hive and learn more.
What's the expensive part? Replenishing the colony?
Well, your equipment expense, getting into it like anything, has start-off costs that can be quite expensive. You could be looking at $600-$700 initial outlay. But people expect that they're going to be able to recoup some of the out-of-pocket costs and also the labor, because a beekeeper will be in their hives pretty much every week. You're dedicating your weekends to doing it, to taking care of them, because it is so much more difficult.
You have to buy bees, too.
And you have to buy bees. And then if you lose 50% or 60%, you have to really continue to invest. And like myself, I haven't had a honey crop in 3 years, but I've had to keep investing each year. And that's a problem.
Why haven't you had a honey crop in 3 years?
Because I've had between 100% and 50% losses over the last 3 years. And so I had to buy new bees, I had to feed them, I had to treat for mites, I had to buy new equipment. Now I keep twice as many colonies in the hopes that I can get half of them through the winter.
It's Bonnie Raindrop of the Central Maryland Beekeepers Association. Before we take our break, I want to go back to Sam Droege and ask a question about native bees.
Mm-hmm.
Help me out here. Help us understand the difference. One can say, well, native bees, those are the ones that are in your backyard, versus those that arrive in the mail and go into Bonnie's hive.
Right.
It's not that simple, is it?
It's not quite that simple. So honeybees, as a group, are Eastern Hemisphere. So they're not native even to the whole hemisphere that we live in. And there are fantastic creatures. They're really, really complex. They've gone way out on the left field in terms of developing this society. And everything we know about bees is about honeybees, and none of that applies to our native species. Almost none of them really are capable of stinging us. We have very little understanding of where they are and what they're doing. Most are super tiny, you know, half the size of a honeybee. They're in everyone's yard. There's over 425 species we've counted right now just in the state of Maryland. You look around the world, 20,000 different species. The way to think about this is every kind of flower has a different kind of bee that goes to that flower. And so that diversity of flowers, go to the florist shop, look at that diversity. That diversity exists in native bees. We don't pay attention because they don't give us any honey.
That's an amazing thing to think about. 20,000 in the world.
Well, those are the ones with names. There's another estimated 20,000 that someone has to name. So we're looking for those younger people who are interested in no money for the rest of their lives to study bees and give them names.
Native or not, they all contribute to pollination, correct?
Yeah, correct. Right. So you have to ask, well, what did all those trees and berries and flowers do before the honeybees came over with the colonists? And the answer is, well, they didn't have a problem because they adapted to the local native bees from the United States and Canada and South America. All were doing their thing. And we have this very, very complicated system. Some of our native bees only go to one species of flower, for example. And others are more like honeybees, where they're generalists. They go to, you know, they don't care so much. So it goes on and on in terms of the complexity.
It's very interesting. If you don't mind, I just go back to my backyard for a moment, because my observation was there was a small sort of a periwinkle colored, is that a color, periwinkle?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, flower there for a little while. Don't ask me to identify it. It's a weed in my yard. I just leave it alone. There was a lot of it this year.
Yeah.
And it's gone now. Mm-hmm. You know, it flowered and went off, disappeared. So there were bees were around at that time.
Right.
There's some other flowers now in the weeds, but I don't see as many bees as there were during that periwinkle time, whatever that was.
Yeah.
So would that have been maybe a bee attracted to that particular flower and then
It could be. And if you ask honey beekeepers, and we'll model that for native bees, this time of year, midsummer, is the low ebb for all bees. Like if you just did a count of all, let's count up all the bees.
Right.
Because resources, i.e. flowers, are at its low end. But one kind of flower, some flowers, you know, for example, like, you know, the yellow sunflowery things that you see along roadsides, those are out. Those have their own set of bees. And there are a few kinds of bees that will build up. They're not quite like honeybees and having queens and colonies. They'll build up their numbers. And they'll just hunker down through this tough spot. In the fall, we get the asters and the goldenrods coming in. They mm-hmm. build back up. Mm-hmm. But many of our species are only out for a little 5-week window when their plant is blooming.
Sam Droege joining us today from the Patuxent Wildlife Research Center, and a co-author of a new book, Bees, An Up-Close Look at Pollinators Around the World. With us in the studio, Bonnie Raindrop from the Central Maryland Beekeepers Association. Comments or questions, welcome here at 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. I see a couple of questions on Twitter, too. You can tweet a question to us at @midday_WYPR, or my name, Dan Rodericks. Welcome back to Midday. Sam Droege, would you just take a moment and describe your book for our listeners, Bees, An Up-Close Look at Pollinators Around the World? Lots of photographs.
Yeah. In fact, the idea is mostly about the photographs. So what we found is that our Flickr site, which is public domain and was a vehicle just to transfer photographs from scientist to scientist because it was free, has been really popular with people who are not scientists. And then we were approached by Vanguard to do a book that featured these photographs and not a scientific book. So the idea is basically a picture book. We love looking at these pictures. We love to show the diversity I talked about, where you have all these sizes and shapes. We have blue bees and green bees, and it's just, you'll be amazed just looking at these things. You can go online and see copies of some of the pictures, and you can then download all these pictures from our Flickr site because we are the government, so everything's free. But what you see is that we do little vignettes. We feature the pictures. You can just look at the pictures. And then if you want, though, we have little paragraphs where we tell essentially funny stories about how we were out in the middle of the jungle catching these things, or in the deserts of Oman, how they got their names, or the really strange things that are not honeybees do when they're out in their environment in Africa, Asia, or elsewhere.
Sam Droege is a wildlife biologist at the Patuxent Wildlife Research Center. The book we're talking about, Bees, An Up-Close Look at Pollinators Around the World, with his co-author, Lawrence Packer. And Bonnie Raindrop is with us from the Central Maryland Beekeepers Association. By the way, when we use the word colony, have I been using that correctly? When we refer to a colony, beekeeper refers to a colony, they refer to the bees that are in their backyard, in their hives?
It's a colony, it's like a superorganism, and they would be in one bee box that you would see, like a white box that would be in some location.
Is your experience with the loss of so many bees, you said the last 3 years, similar to what other members of the association are experiencing?
Oh, yes.
That scale, what,
absolutely.
A 50 to 60% loss of bees?
Yes. And these are, a lot of these people experiencing losses have been beekeepers for like 20 and 30 years. So they really understand honeybees and how to keep them healthy. And they're seeing unprecedented things happen.
So you buy more bees, hoping that maybe next time the mite doesn't show up, maybe next time they don't bring neonics back to the hive.
We know the mite's going to show up, you know, and we know they're going to encounter toxins. And I guess in a way, you just have to be a passionate optimist about honeybees, that, you know, that there's something that you may be able to do that can just give them a little bit of an edge so that they can survive.
Let's take another call for Bonnie or Sam. This is Ed in Whaleyville, Maryland, which is on the Eastern Shore, right, Ed?
Yes, just outside of Ocean City.
Okay.
How are you today?
Nice to hear from you. Go right ahead with your question.
Well, it really doesn't pertain to the subject matter, but pertaining to the subject matter, we have a beekeeper here locally, and he harvests his honey and goes through the winter with them. But living in a rural area like I do, I have a cornfield right across the street, and we have a half a dozen horses here. And every year they spray the Roundup and other insecticides and things on soybeans and corn, and it just blows right over. I mean, does that affect us also on top of the bees and things around us? That's pretty much my question.
Yeah, I understand.
That be addressed along with the legislation?
Yeah. Bonnie or Sam, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, it's either negative or neutral. You know, what the degree is, it's not an on-off button. It's like any kind of toxin in the environment. You know, a bee may be tolerant or not tolerant to small doses, and we're the same way. So it's really difficult to be declarative about whether that's bad or how bad. It's a matter of dose, so the same kind of thing. So, yeah, you want to minimize your contact with pesticides, and that's what regulations are supposed to be doing. So how I can answer your question specifically and whether the farmer is doing anything that is not within those boundaries of proper field management, I can't really say. I don't think anyone can say per se, but we just have to be really careful about how things are applied.
Bonnie, does the Central Maryland Beekeepers Association, does your website have a list of less toxic, say, pesticides or herbicides that people can use? We have a question here on Twitter about that. Someone's concerned about reducing a mosquito population around her property, doesn't want to affect the bees. Do you have information like that?
Yes, we do. And they can go to centralmarylandbees.org. And I'll go in and double check that when I get off the air to make sure that it is posted. I believe it's also posted on the smartonpesticides.org.
Smartonpesticides.org.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much. Go ahead, Sam.
And can I also point out that one way to reduce your pesticide load or your what you're trying to do is to think of your yard not as a corporate you know, uniform environment where everything looks perfect, but to think of it more as a little mini refuge. So for a bee or an insect, that's the scale that they live in. And so bees come in, live out their entire lives. So you want a lot of complexity. If you, like a farmer, put only one crop, i.e. grass that's 5 inches tall, then something else is going to come in and eat it and wreck that. Same thing with our foundation plants. So the short answer is lots of native plants rather than plants from other parts of the world, because that resonates with our local insects and they're not going to cause as many pest problems. And to not worry so much about having that uniform grass, or even minimizing your grass to begin with, as a sort of a new objective for how you live in that space. Don't think of your space as something that is separate from nature. It's a big part of nature. And the more that we have heavy-duty agriculture, which is all about producing crops, the more we're going to depend on people's houses and lawns becoming part of the environment. And so this is how you can play a factor in that.
One of our listeners, Michelle in Elsinore Village, wanted some information about plants that are helpful to bees and monarch butterflies. We did a show on monarch butterflies about a month ago, and I posted some information from the state of Maryland and some other organizations, very helpful in terms of what plants attract monarchs and are good for butterflies. We'll try to get that back up and freshen up our Facebook page on that. Bill in Baltimore had something to say along those lines. Thanks for joining us on Midday.
Yes, I'm a beekeeper here in Baltimore myself. I just wanted to say, just to clarify, the forage for honeybees here in Maryland is mostly tree-based forage. The bees aren't generally foraging in any abundance on the plants. It's mostly in the large trees, such as the linden trees, the holly trees, and trees that are blooming and have the pollen and nectar sources. Those are our main forage plants here in Maryland.
So Your suggestion for those who want to contribute is plant some trees that flower nicely, right, Bill? Thank you. And you concur with that, Bonnie Raindrop?
Yes, yes. The black locust is abundant and is one of our primary nectar sources. And also be aware, too, that the trees that are sprayed or treated with neonics are going to become toxic. And, you know, we've all heard, I think, probably about the 50,000 bumblebees that were killed out in Oregon 2 years ago. And that was when the neonic was applied, you know, according to instructions. But yet it had a devastating effect and killed a massive amounts of bees. So we are hearing from other beekeepers that they're recognizing that they're experiencing some pesticide kills from these kinds of applications.
So be careful what you spray. Smarten up about it. Read about it. Get informed. And also consider some of what Sam had to say there about your maybe too neat backyard, too neat for the bees. Lighten up a little bit on the herbicides and pesticides. Right, Sam?
You got it.
Yeah, okay. And we'll try to get some information from the Central Maryland Bees Beekeepers Association and smartonpesticides.org up on our Facebook page this afternoon. Thank you very much to Bonnie Raindrop from the Central Maryland Beekeepers for being with us today. Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you so much.
And Sam, nice to see you again.
Thank you.
Sam Droege, wildlife biologist from the Patuxent Wildlife Research Center. Again, his book is now out on Amazon. Bees, an up-close look at pollinators around the world. Some fascinating photographs. You can sample them on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Aaron Morenzi, Aaliyah Satterfield, Kaylee Sodick, and Campbell Reed. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.